City, and coming up next, What's Going On with Rebecca Miles.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.
Welcome to the show. Good morning. What's going on this morning is that it's 25 degrees. It feels like 14 degrees. It's going up to 34, cloudy with a little bit of sun. I'm the host of the Wednesday morning What's Going On, Rebecca Miles. You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. We'll be going shortly to the Pacifica Radio National Morning Newscast, but just later on the show, yesterday marked the 20th anniversary of the arrival of the first prisoners at Guantanamo Bay Prison. The U.S. military prison in Cuba began during the George W. Bush administration. The U.S. held 774 men at the secretive prison, imprisoned without trial, tortured, and absent the rule of law. Most were never charged with a crime. The prison has remained open during the administrations of the Barack Obama, Donald Trump, and now Joe Biden. Both Obama and Biden had said they would close the prison. Joining us on the show later will be Andy Worthington. He's the co-founder of Close Guantanamo Campaign and the author of The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison. He's also the co-director with Polly Nash of the documentary film Outside the Law, Stories from Guantanamo. And later in the show, we'll be joined by New York Assemblyman Ron Kim, who represents District 40, that's in Flushing, Queens. Assemblyman Kim was one of the few Democrats who questioned the Cuomo's administration over nursing home deaths and the subsequent cover-up, which is now being investigated by, excuse me, just lost my voice there this early in the morning for me, who had covered up the number of nursing home deaths, which is now being investigated by the New York State Attorney General, and whose name got prominence when he questioned the Cuomo administration. Kim was re-elected to his third term to represent the 40th Assembly District in November 2016, and he's the first and only Korean-American ever elected to the New York State Legislature. We'll be talking to him about a report his team have brought out, the Nonprofit War on Workers, which is looking at home care workers and the exploitation and theft of wages. And he'll tell us all about some of the findings of that report later in the show. We'll go now to the Pacifica National Newscast.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I've been having these quiet conversations with members of Congress for the last 2 months. I'm tired of being quiet.
President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris turned up the heat on opponents of election reform on Tuesday in Atlanta.
History has never been kind to those who've sided with voter suppression over voters' rights. And it'll be even be less kind for those who side with election subversion.
They're calling on the Senate to pass the For the People Act and to change filibuster rules to make it happen.
The American people have waited long enough. The Senate must act.
But GOP senators see things differently, accusing Democrats of trying to federalize elections. Here's Republican Senator John Barrasso of Wyoming.
Ballot integrity, ballot accountability, ballot security, that's what we're here fighting to defend.
And Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia argues the filibuster is crucial for bipartisanship.
By having the filibuster in place to make sure that we don't have the dramatic swings from administration to administration, from majority to minority, Republican to Democrat, and that we keep the ship sort of going in the right direction.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer wants a floor vote by January 17th. Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says he's running again. The Kentucky Republican was elected to a seventh term in 2020 by a nearly 20-point margin, but has since been at odds with former President Donald Trump. Should Republicans win back the House in November, Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy is promising to remove Democrats Adam Schiff, Eric Swalwell, and Ilhan Omar from their committee assignments. McCarthy says Democrats created a new standard by removing GOP Representatives Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia and Paul Gosar of Arizona from their committees for inflammatory rhetoric. U.S. Capitol security officials say the complex is much safer than a year ago, but note further improvements are needed. Police Chief Tom Major told lawmakers careful consideration will be used in the future about the use of protective fencing.
We understand the impact it has on the community. Many members don't like it.
Meanwhile, the House panel investigating the January 6th attack at the Capitol is deciding just how aggressively it should pursue information after Republican Congressmen Scott Perry and Jim Jordan both refused voluntary interviews. On Tuesday, the panel issued subpoenas for two advisors to Donald Trump Jr., the former president's eldest son. Dr. Anthony Fauci sparred with Republicans during a Senate hearing, accusing Rand Paul of fueling threats against him. That was after the Kentucky senator accused him of smearing doctors with differing opinions.
So your desire to take
You're
down people...
You're incorrect. As usual, Senator, you are incorrect. Almost everything you
said. Well, no, you deny. You deny.
The nation's top infectious disease doctor was later caught using choice words for Kansas Senator Roger Marshall, who accused him of hiding financial disclosures.
What a moron.
Fauci noted the documents are public record. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
And thank you, Nancy. Mary Sherman for that national news broadcast from Pacifica. You're listening to What's Going On over WBAI. I'm Rebecca Miles. The time is 7:07. Before we get to our guest, I wanted to invite Caleb Maupin, who is a U.S. A journalist and political analyst, to just to cover what is happening with all these discussions, the U.S. And Russia security talks, which started on Monday in Geneva with a meeting with NATO today, and the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe on Thursday, which will include discussions between Ukraine and Russian officials. Back in December, Russia President Vladimir Putin and U.S. President Joe Biden met with each other. And out of a consequence of that meeting was the drafting of two treaties, a security treaty and a security between NATO and Russia. The latter would bar Ukraine and Georgia from joining NATO, ruling out an eastward expansion by the Atlantic Military Alliance, and also to roll back NATO's military presence in Eastern Europe to 1990s levels. Both those treaties have, in essence, stalled. So, Caleb, welcome to the show this morning. What have you been seeing in these discussions, and what should we take up from it? And what concerns should we have about Russia, according to the Biden administration, having 100,000 troops near the Ukraine border in recent months?
Well, here's the thing. I think there are two underlying drives behind these talks. The first is the drive for peace, because I think people in Russia don't want a war with the United States. People in the United States don't want a war with Russia. People in Western Europe and Eastern Europe don't want a war. And so everyone wants peace. But at the same time, underlying that, there is a drive to remove Russia from the markets. You know, it's particularly cold outside, and it's a particularly cold winter, especially in Western Europe. And the price of natural gas right now is through the roof. It's through the roof. And American natural gas companies and British natural gas companies are making a killing. I mean, they are making a huge amount of money. And what could ruin this kind of perfect storm for the natural gas companies, right? I mean, we got the pandemic, and there's been, at this point, supply chain issues. On top of that, we have a situation where there's a particularly cold winter, and lots of money is being made by supplying Western Europe with natural gas. What could ruin it is if Russia got in on those markets, right? We have the Nord Stream 2 natural gas pipeline, which connects Russia to Germany. That's this huge pipeline that's been built, but it hasn't been turned on yet. And Russia has a huge state-owned natural gas company called Gazprom, and they're ready to start selling natural gas to Europe. But if they do that, then the natural gas companies that are making a killing right now suddenly have to deal with a competitor. Then there's more natural gas on the market, and the price of natural gas goes down. So there is a real economic incentive here for tension between Western Europe and the NATO countries and Russia to escalate right now, to keep that price of natural gas high, to keep Russia out of the natural gas markets in Western Europe. And that is really underlying all of this, in my view, that if relations between Russia and Western Europe and Russia and the NATO countries got better at that point, then the natural gas companies would lose out. Russia wants peace, but I think there are some forces in the United States that fear Russia increasing its role in the international markets. They fear Russia emerging as a natural gas competitor and selling natural gas to Europe.
Caleb, I'm very sorry about this, but we're going to have to leave it there. But that was wonderfully insightful merging of economic and political points of view, which oftentimes is not part of the discourse. We usually just hear about the political point without fully understanding the business interests, of course. That was Caleb Maupin, journalist and political analyst. He's the founder and creator of the Center for Political Innovation. You can follow him on Twitter, and he's often, almost daily, on YouTube. He has his own channel. That's Caleb, K-A-L-E-P, Maupin, M-A-U-P-I-N. Thank you very much for coming on the show this morning, Caleb.
For sure thing. Thank you.
And now we'll go to our guest, Andy Worthington, just to explain that Tuesday marked the 20th anniversary of the arrival of the first prisoners at Guantanamo Bay Prison. Andy Worthington is the co-founder of the Close Guantanamo campaign and the author of the Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's legal prison. He was out at the weekend protesting and demanding the closure of the prison. There were some pictures of him at Trafalgar Square with speakers. Normally, of course, at this time of year, he's outside the White House, but I suspect because of COVID and restrictions on travel, he wasn't there this year. We'll hear from him. Hello, Andy. Welcome to the show.
Hi there, Rebecca. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you just fine. You're coming in very nicely.
Oh, that's great.
One news item that I just wanted to start the show with, that U.S. government review panel has approved the release of five men. This was announced yesterday, who have been held for years without charge at Guantanamo Bay. Those decisions were released by the Pentagon yesterday. And which, you know, take the anniversary to do something. That's great. But what are you hearing about the Biden administration working to close the prison anytime soon?
Well, to be honest, Rebecca, we're not hearing anything publicly. I don't think that Joe Biden has made a single statement about Guantanamo since he became president, although various spokespeople have mentioned that there's a review underway and that the president intends to close it before he leaves office. I can understand that he wants to keep things under the radar because, he's aware, especially from his experience with Barack Obama, of how readily cynical Republicans will leap on anything that moves positively towards the closure of Guantanamo. So, let's start with this announcement of the five men who've been approved for release, because it is actually quite significant, and obviously quite amusing that that announcement took place on the day of the anniversary to deflect criticism of President Biden's general inaction since he took office on Guantanamo. These approvals for release are the most practical way that the Biden administration can release from Guantanamo everyone who isn't a significant prisoner who is charged with a crime. So of the 39 men who are still held at Guantanamo, 10 of them are in pretrial hearings in the broken military commission system that doesn't really work, but that's a separate issue. And two of them have been convicted. So it's the 27 others that are the particular issue of if President Biden means what he says about wanting to close Guantanamo, then he has to release all of these men unless he's going to charge any of them. And what we've seen in the last year is two letters sent to him by 24 senators and 75 members of the House of Representatives, not only urging him to close Guantanamo, but also pointing out how absolutely unacceptable it is that after 20 years, the United States is still holding people indefinitely without charge or trial. So I think this method of securing approval for the release of these men who have never been charged and are not going to be charged through the periodic review boards is the best way forward. The caveat is he has now approved 13 men for release during his presidency. He inherited five other men from previous administrations, but he hasn't released anyone. Of these men that have been approved for release since he took office, not a single one of them has actually been freed. And we're able to look back now to, for example, a decision that was taken in May to release Saifullah Paraka. He's Guantanamo's oldest prisoner. He's in his 70s. He's had three heart attacks at Guantanamo. He was accused of some involvement with al-Qaeda because he'd met Osama bin Laden at a couple of business meetings over 20 years ago. But the United States has accepted that it had talked up a story that really wasn't very real and has approved him for release. Why has he not been put on a plane and sent back to his family in Pakistan? This really shouldn't be a complicated issue. So what we really need to see is action on releasing men who have been approved for release, because otherwise it makes a mockery of the entire process.
The other remaining 27, there's been no movement on the military commission trials. They haven't been charged. They're just indefinitely detained.
Yeah. So, and the truly sad and shocking thing, I think, about all of this is that while it's gratifying to hear about the approval for release of these five men, one of these men is a Somali guy who, was one of the last prisoners, one of the high value detainees to arrive at the prison in September 2006. So he's technically the first high value detainee where the US has walked back from its claims of, the insane dangerousness of all the high value detainees, because, mistakes were made in the CIA black site program, not only in torturing people in general, but also in the fact that they captured people who they dressed up as being more significant than they were. So,
yes.
So that's a good thing. But the very sad news that actually, I heard from one of the lawyers yesterday is that another man has had his ongoing imprisonment endlessly without charge or trial approved. Now, this is a man called Khalid Qasim, who, was never more than a foot soldier for the Taliban, who was in Afghanistan before 9/11, who, the way that everyone who was out in Afghanistan at that time suddenly morphed into terrorists after the 9/11 attacks. Khalid is an extraordinarily talented artist. He's clearly very bright. He's been, throughout his time at Guantanamo, has represented the prisoners to try and secure better living conditions for them. He was for many years a persistent hunger striker. He has not behaved well in Guantanamo. Now, the problem is You know, why would you blame somebody for not behaving well in Guantanamo when they've had two decades of their life stolen from them and been treated appallingly and also been denied any form of due process? But what happened with Khalid is that he's angry. He went. He apparently was at this meeting with the Pentagon and with these senior officials who review the cases of the men. And it's a parole type process. These men have to show contrition and indicate to the board that they will constructively and peacefully put their lives together after release. He has no idea what he's going to do with his life. All he feels is that he's been robbed of 20 years of opportunities for training, for anything. And he's been incapable of disguising that. And so we're left in this absurd position where, because of his attitude, the United States now, the very government of President Biden now, has suggested that it's okay to hold this man for the rest of his life, because he doesn't have an attitude that they think is appropriate.
Right, right.
It's worth reflecting on just for a moment, isn't it, Rebecca? It's truly appalling. You know, eventually they are going to have to approve him for release. But I'm so shocked by it that it's all based around behavior. Nothing to do with what you did or didn't do before you got there 20 years ago. Just absolutely shocking.
Yeah, yeah. And what with your organization, you ordinarily protest outside the White House. What else are you able to do? Do you petition all year round for the closing of Guantanamo?
Well, I suppose primarily we try and just educate, and we try and keep Guantanamo in the public eye. You know, the blunt truth is that the mainstream media rarely bothers itself with Guantanamo. I mean, there was a flurry of activity yesterday, but you know, the way that the mainstream media operates so much is that they move on within 24 or 48 hours of whatever it is. They've moved on to something else and it gets forgotten about. So I think over all of these years, everybody who cares about Guantanamo, and, you know, sometimes that number's no more than hundreds of people, sometimes it's in the thousands. By keeping on talking about it, you know, it has helped over the years. It helped under President Obama to keep putting pressure on him when he sat on his hands, as he so often did, because it was, you know, it was difficult for him to overcome this cynical Republican opposition that he faced. But closing Guantanamo requires courage. It requires political courage. And he often wasn't prepared to do that. He took the easier route of doing nothing for many years of his presidency. It requires robust action. And I suppose what we all do is remind people of that, because although lawyers are still fighting to fundamentally secure due process rights for the men still held at Guantanamo, how on earth can that still be happening after 20 years?
Mm.
The legal route has largely been shut down, sadly. So Guantanamo is a place where, if you like, I would say that, you know, the circumstances in which men are held indefinitely without charge or trial is akin to the behavior of a dictatorship. It's not the way that a country that claims to respect the rule of law behaves. And so highlighting this chronic injustice is absolutely crucial.
Yeah. I will just open the phone lines to see if there's any callers this morning. 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. Of course, I'm reminded when in talking to you that the revelations about who the 774 detainees were, of course, came through the releases through WikiLeaks. Where names, you were able to identify the names of people and you documented this. And of course, we're about 1,000 days now into where Julian Assange has been held as a political prisoner, as, you know, he's not out on bail while his case goes through the courts in England. How important were those releases in helping to document who was being held in Guantanamo?
Well, they were significant, Rebecca, because they actually put names to the people who had identified their fellow prisoners under various forms of duress or bribery as, you know, having been more significant than they were. It helped to identify that there were a number of prolific and persistent liars within Guantanamo, but also a smaller number of, quite a large number of other prisoners who also lied, not as much. Now, I'm not blaming anyone for lying in Guantanamo. The entire process was set up to break people until they told them what they wanted to hear. You know, imagine being woken up and interrogated in the middle of the night, every night, possibly for years, with photos put in front of you. You know these people, tell us who they are. So I think it was extraordinarily significant for that. And it's good that you're mentioning Julian Assange and the 1,000 days that he spent in Belmarsh. Actually, that's fundamentally part of the problem with the extradition treaty between the US and the UK, is that because of challenges and because of the slow way that courts move, people can spend many, many, many years in this kind of limbo where, there was a prisoner called Babar Ahmed who spent 8 years challenging his extradition before finally losing that battle and being sent to the US. But it's important for us to remember Julian Assange because he is being made the victim of something that is actually quite crucially about press freedom. He is the Chelsea Manning, obviously, was punished and then sentenced and then released for having leaked this information in the first place. But other than that, no one has been targeted like Julian Assange is. And everything that WikiLeaks released that came from this trove of documents from Chelsea Manning, everyone else involved was the mainstream media. They were absolutely involved in every step of it. And they need to not just take the position of, you know, wiping their brows and feeling relieved that they also haven't been targeted, but to recognize how absolutely crucial it is that the charges against Julian Assange are dropped because of the pernicious and chilling effect that it will have on press freedom overall.
Right. Andy, I think we're going to leave it there. We don't seem to have any calls. It may be that I'm not sure why that is, but we're going to leave it there. Andy, thank you very much for coming on the show this morning.
Well, thank you, Rebecca. It's lovely to talk to you again. And see you again in New York one of these days, hopefully.
Yes, I hope to. Yes. And I hope we see some movement on the closure, or at least a release of the five men that they announced yesterday, and overall the 27 others, and that there is some movement towards closing this prison, which really should never have been open in the first place. And certainly this idea of indefinite detention has to be rolled back. It's just outrageous and violates Geneva conventions, and these rules of law should matter. They really should. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
You're welcome. Thanks, Rebecca.
Okay, good morning. And welcome back to the show. I'm Rebecca Miles, the host of What's Going On Wednesdays. It's currently 25 degrees, feels like 14 degrees, going up to 34 degrees. Later today, cloudy with some sun. I'm watching some blue sky coming through at the moment. In the second half of the show, we are going to be joined by New York Assemblyman Ron Kim, who represents District 40 in Flushing, Queens. He was re-elected to his third term as representative of the district in November 2016. He is the first and only Korean-American ever elected to the New York State Legislature. He's a member of several committees, including education and housing, and is chair for the Committee on Aging. Welcome to the show, Mr. Kim.
Hey, Rebecca. Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Great. I'm delighted to have you. I wanted to talk to you about this lengthy report. It's about 100 pages put together by your legislative director, and it's entitled The Nonprofit War on Workers, and it documents extensively the sort of exploitation of workers who are in the home care workers, documents wage theft, it shows pay stubs. So tell me what led up to this, the decision to put this report together.
Right. Around April of last year, we sat down with the advocates for the home care workers who have been pushing back for almost 10 years against this particular provider, Chinese American Planning Council, CPC, to collect the back wages that they're owed. These home care workers have been working 24-hour shifts for years, but only to find out they're getting compensated for up to 12 to 13 hours of that work. Legally, the employer is obligated after a 13-hour shift to cover the rest if they're forced to work 24 hours at homes of their patients. We're fighting to end the 24-hour work shifts. It is inhumane for anyone to be in a work environment, to be in that kind of space. These workers are now older adults themselves. They have health issues. They're physically hurt because of the years of the conditions that they have to suffer from. And that's when I felt compelled to get involved. And I met with the leading directors of CPC, who I, you know, been aligned with for many years. You know, this is CPC, the nonprofit is a mega nonprofit, Rebecca. They're vertically, laterally integrated, and they are what I, you know, label as a monopsony. They have full control of the markets in our communities like ours, from adult literacy to childcare to senior centers to home care. And they have tremendous leverage to do the right thing, but instead they chose to fight the workers in court over the last 6 years.
Right. Now, the CPC is the Chinese American Planning Council, and I understand in this instance it employs about 4,500 home health aides. So these are majority women, immigrant low income, who go into people's home and help with, if you've suffered a stroke, they're there, they come and help you and take care of you, feed you, clean you. Very crucial work. Oftentimes families rely heavily on women like this to assist them. But what you document in this report is this cynical attempt to move their complaints through the courts, move them to different districts, at one point even moving the complaint to a federal court. And in the end, at one point, the CPC said, well, you know, we can't meet these payments because it would put us out of business. I think at one point, the calculation was the workers were owed in total $14 million. And based on the number of complainants in the two lawsuits, the class action lawsuits, we were talking about 145 plaintiffs, all told that they're all due, if you break down the numbers evenly, and I'm sure it's not that simple, but that we're talking about $100,000 owed to these families. Not only did they kind of refuse to meet their obligation and pay these wages for overtime and for the full hours that they worked, but then they also made a deal with a local union, 1199 SEIU. What happened there? How did that collaboration come about to further weaken the plaintiff's cause?
Right. So 1199, the largest healthcare labor union in our state and perhaps in the country, they represent the CPC workers, and they went into collective agreement. And without the workers having full knowledge of what they signed up for, they signed up to agree to mandatory arbitration, meaning that their right to recourse to take their employer to court were limited, and they were forced to arbitrate privately. And most of these cases during mandatory arbitration, it hurts the workers. It suppresses workers' rights, and they get a small, very small fraction of what they're actually owed. The intent of how they framed this many years ago, of why they signed up for these type of agreements, is to give the impression of stability, that this sector won't be disrupted, that there's industry stability, and we're saving money and we're providing services. But what's happening over many decades now is that legal tactics like this is fundamentally designed to suppress workers' rights to a point where Congress has stepped in and banned it and tried to ban the practice. So 1199 and CPC and the state, they've all been part of a series of bad decisions that culminated in worker exploitation. And instead of being honest about some of the mishaps, mistakes that they've made in the past, they're doubling down on their corporate lawyers that have a long history of representing big oil and other big companies that have deployed similar tactics to dodge accountability and to, you know, like you said, take the courts to federal courts for federal preemptions, codifying the laws on their own, the courts, by bypassing state regulations of wage regulations. They're using some of the worst tactics while giving the public that this is a nonprofit, that these are progressive executives that show up to other progressive issues. So there's a lot of deceit that's involved in how they're presenting themselves to the public, but their actions in courts tell an entirely different story.
Right. So as chair of the Committee on Aging for the Assembly, what are you able to do? Are you able to change any of the laws in terms of, you mentioned, wanting to push back on this idea of a 24-hour shift? Are you able to make those sort of changes, and how would that find some resolution for these women who've been ripped off?
Yeah, my number one focus right now is to get CPC and other providers like them to settle the back wages. And yes, it might be a 40, 80, I don't know is that exact number, but it's in that range. But if they don't have the money, at least take the right steps forward to start raising the money and come to the table with the workers to come up with the plan. But they haven't even tried to do that. They're just going in a different direction. There's things we can do legislatively. My colleagues introduced bills to ban the 24-hour practice, which I 100% support. There are things that we can do prospectively to fight for better wage, livable wages for home care workers, which would fix the next class, next generation of home care workers that should be paid a lot more than below minimum wage in places like upstate New York. But that doesn't resolve the retroactive injustice that these immigrant woman workers have suffered from for the last 10 years. And unless we get that right, the foundation of the care sector, the home care space, and the entire ecosystem will be based on exploitative and racist policies that have hurt multiple generations of mostly immigrant worker women.
Right. The other thing, of course, that we're facing is that, you know, there's about 400,000 workers available to do this kind of work. But as we're watching the population age, you've also got all the baby boomers now who are starting to retire, who are starting to need help. This need is just going to become incrementally more needed, more help from home care workers. Is the state ready to address this growing need that's likely to come in the next 10, 15 years?
I don't think our state or any state in this country is prepared for the long-term health crisis of this nation. As you mentioned, Rebecca, the 65-plus population is going to quadruple in the next couple of decades. It is a full-blown crisis. And every time policymakers come to the table to discuss long-term solutions, they usually leave a table without any answers, frustrated, and just end up focusing on small band-aids to try to give the public the impression that our system works. But a system does not work. The nursing homes, the home care, the intermediaries, the managed care companies that handle the reimbursements of Medicaid, Medicare, the insurance, they're also royally corrupt. How could we have for-profit intermediaries that are designed to extract profits and diminish care work, handling reimbursements? The foundational model of how we handle care is broken. And unless we can come to a moment of reckoning and recognition that we need the public sector, the public capital, to step in and take charge of these failing markets, we will never get to a better place. And every time we discuss about public takeovers or a public, you know, sector, public option, everyone, you know, on the other side, on the corporate side, will reduce this to a socialist or a communist or any kind of fear-mongering language that to scare the public away from it. But that's simply, you know, I think at this point, un-American. You know, we need a balanced mixed economy of private public capital. And right now, everything we do, including long-term care, has been privatized, and it is going to destroy this country.
I just want to let listeners know that if they've got any questions for Assemblyman Ron Kim, the number to call is 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. Just picking up on that, this idea of national healthcare. Of course, we're in the middle of this COVID epidemic. Everybody has their stories. I was trying to get a test and I was standing in the street for, you know, a couple of hours. I was watching all these families who were trying to get tests so their children could go to daycare or back to school. And we're all lining up to get tested in what looked like a metal container. It wasn't even a proper clinic. And these are dotted all around the city. It just seems, and this is 2 years after the state has now been in one of the epicenters of during the COVID epidemic, and it seems that we're no further along towards providing like a full rounded service. What has your experience been with COVID and the patchy service that we're getting?
Yeah, it's completely pathetic. And especially in places like New York City and New York State, we are, Rebecca, as you probably already know this, we are the wealthiest state in the nation. Even during COVID, the top class have doubled their wealth. The billionaires, despite us passing some incremental progressive taxes last year. They haven't left. Capital is still growing. Private capital is still growing and strong in New York. And instead of figuring out how to provide better revenue streams to take care of the most vulnerable members, because this is a pandemic and we are as strong as the weakest link in our neighborhood, people still are so conditioned to extract as much money and value from the bottom communities and left the vulnerable out to dry. We have committed elder side during this pandemic. We have 16,000 seniors last year, older adults who died, who were sacrificed during this pandemic because we didn't have the courage to raise new revenues, to build more facilities in real time, to handle the displacement of thousands of older adults as we made bed, as a system that made bed, that make beds for people who they deemed that they could save over older people's lives. Mm. And that's the story that will be told sooner or later in this moment of history. And this will be the biggest, I think, mistake, and a dark chapter in, I think, American, policymaking. And instead of waking up and doing the right thing, you know, we are still struggling to even get testing correctly. And mm-hmm. I want to tie this back to revenues and taxes because and how we do finance in New York. Despite being wealthy, we spend between $3 to $3.5 billion with the B in New York State on in paying off interest alone to money we borrowed from Wall Street for the public sector. So in the middle of a pandemic, we're giving $3.5 billion just in interest to Wall Street because that's the money that we relied on for the public sector. That's what I mean by we have an imbalance of private public capital. And unless we have a grip on how to regain our status in the public sector, we're going to see the same similar outcomes in doing public catastrophes, or natural catastrophes.
Great. I understand we have three calls. Hello, caller. You're on air and you're with Assemblyman Ron Kim.
Daryl McPherson, Bronx, New York. Hello, Ms. Miles and Assemblyman Kim.
Hello.
Yes, you're on the air. What's your question, caller?
Thank you so much. I apologize for it's hard to know when you're on the air. Okay, really quickly, what's the status of the New York Health Care Act? Can we get it passed quickly so that we can move on to single payer in New York State? Two, trying to build two complete hospitals during the pandemic in 2 weeks. And Forbes Real-Time Billionaires is a great website to track the net worth of the 100 richest people in the world. For instance, last week, Elon Musk made $36 billion in one trading day, 5 p.m. to 5 p.m. Last thing, is there any way that we can get people to force their representatives to keep the tax that we collect from Wall Street? And thank you, Representative Kim, for getting the former governor out of office.
Well, thank you for all those questions and your feedback. Let me start off with the New York Health Act. This is something that the chair of the Health Committee, my good colleague and mentor, Dick Gottfried, has been passing in the assembly for almost 30 years now. Mm. And he is retiring after being the longest serving lawmaker in the history of New York. I think he served almost 50 years since he was 21 years old. And this is the one issue that he wants to get done before he retires this year. And I'm fully on board. There's some issues with municipal worker unions and internal politics, but if we can't get this done in the middle of a pandemic to get rid of the profit-seeking models, the intermediaries, and really have a robust public option that keeps public benefits efficiently and effectively flowing to the end user, the person who's sitting in these nursing homes or hospitals, then I think we are failing as a government, as a society. And I'm hoping that we'll finally get there. In terms of taxes and revenues, it's all interconnected. We need progressive tax justice to give sustainable and robust economies that takes care of our communities and our people that are in need. And we can't just rely on one-time rejections. Every time we have a big recession every 10, 11 years in the federal government to bail us out, but that money is not sustainable. And it doesn't do anything about addressing the concentration of power and wealth, which is completely out of control at the very top. And the millionaires, the private equity firms, the hedge funds that I've sat down with over the years, they understand this. They're completely in shock whenever they get their returns from tax from the government on their capital gains tax, like, breaks. They didn't ask for these, but they're getting all this money back, and they're not even, you know, investing it back to the communities. You know, they're just buying second, third, fourth homes in the Hamptons and completely, you know, being opposite of the goal why the decision makers give out these tax breaks in the first place. So I think there is a collective alignment between even the wealthier class that there's something is broken and we need a better balance to move this economy forward.
Great. Caller, we've got time for one more caller. Hello, caller, you've reached the air.
Yes. Greetings to the beloved community. I just want to affirm the point you're making and suggest that there be some type of a presentation that the public can easily digest, which would include over 100 years ago when the so-called Spanish flu brought such a toll, and many nations thought it was obvious to have a universal health plan. And I think that it also needs to consider preventive and nature alternative. It needs to be an integrated plan, because some people, and especially communities that were marginalized, medical apartheid, Tuskegee syphilis experiment, et cetera, people gravitate towards nature. It's much less expensive than allopathic, which is great when it comes to trauma. So that's my comment, and thank you, Assemblyman Kim.
Thank you so much for that. That is actually extremely fascinating, because I'm working with regenerative farms in upstate New York that have focused on policies like legalizing everything in nature, as we've opened up multiple studies around what things like fungi can do to give us real solutions around health, dementia, and a number of illnesses that are actually, the solutions are right beneath us. It's part of our planet. It's right there, ingrained in our DNAs, but we've stopped researching this for almost 40 years since the war on drugs in the 60s. But finally, they've opened up this lab. So we're very excited at the research that's about to come out, because as you inferred, everything we've done in healthcare is short-sighted, and from hospitals to even, you know, of course, I got all my vaccinations, but it's designed around for-profit big pharma companies that may not actually want real solutions. You know, they benefit from people suffering from diabetes, from illnesses. So, you know, I think, but there is a movement, a strong movement in places like Oregon and other states to unleash the power of, as you refer to, as nature. So I'm very focused on the outcome of those studies as well.
Great. We're going to have to leave it there. New York Assemblyman Ron Kim, who represents the 40th District in Flushing, Queens, thank you so much for joining us on the show this morning. I hope to have you back. I'd love to hear more about how, whether we can get some resolution for these women who cared about other people and get their back pay sorted. I'd love to have you come back on the show if there's been any more developments on that. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Rebecca. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye. And that's all for the show this morning. Coming up will be Democracy Now! And tomorrow, join Felipe Luciano for What's Going On. Of course, please donate if you find this content useful. Please donate to the Tower Fund. We're trying now. We were able to successfully pay the back rent for last year. We're now raising $200,000 for this year's rent. It would cover us for the whole year. It's an ambitious goal, but I know you all care about the station. You care about what you hear here, and you want to support us and keep us going. I'd be most grateful if you could do that. The number to call is 212-209-282950. Thank you to Michael Haskins and to all our guests this morning, and to Linda Perry, executive producer on the show. Good morning.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In September, Harvard University announced that it will no longer invest in fossil fuels.
I think we do have to chalk up this win to a huge win for activism, and I've been so inspired by the undergrads that are leading this movement.
John Verghese is a Master of Public Policy student at the Harvard Kennedy School. He's part of a student-led activist group that for 10 years has been pushing the university to divest its endowment from the fossil fuel industry. Student activists have led demonstrations on campus, including sit-ins, marches, and speeches. On one parents' weekend, they even poured molasses on each other to simulate an oil spill. And in 2021, students filed a complaint with the Attorney General of Massachusetts. They argued that Harvard's investment in fossil fuels violates the university's legal responsibilities. Verghese says institutions must stop investing money in the companies driving global warming.
On a moral level, you know, if your house is on fire, why would you stand with the arsonists?
With an endowment valued at more than $50 billion, Harvard is the richest university in the world, and its financial decisions carry enormous influence. So even though Verghese is frustrated by how long it took to get to this step,
I don't think that we can understate the importance of this victory.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Breathe deep.
Breathe deep.
Expand your mind.
And let the music be your driving force.
Enter a world of color and light.
And keep on thinking free.
The most eclectic mix of music in the city that never sleeps. At 99.5 FM WBAI New York. And streaming live at www.wbai.org.
Permíteme soñar que pueda ser verdad.